Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by Jennifer Burge, CEO of Worldwise Coaching. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad you're here. And Dr. Jeff McGee, CEO of Cross Cultural Dynamics. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, our theme for the show is international, cross-cultural, multicultural, diversity, all the things, because even though our show tends to focus on companies and organizations here in the Valley, we live in a global village. And you're doing work that is important in helping companies, helping individuals navigate through the world we actually live in,
right,
which is often more diverse and has different expectations, different norms, different ways of doing business and life than what we commonly find around the corner or across the way. So, Jennifer, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about Worldwise Coaching. What kind of work do you do? How do you serve folks?
So that's a great question to start off with. Thank you. I am the product of four different continents now. I guess I came back to the Valley last year after 17 years overseas. And what sent me overseas was my technical software experience. And it was supposed to be a 1 year, 12-month assignment in Germany. And while I had decided that I would stretch it as long as humanly possible, I certainly did expect it to last for 17 years. So with that experience in working, leading projects in 10 different countries, traveling to over 50, when I came back to the United States, I was trying to decide exactly what was the best use of all of that experience. And because I found working in different cultures and environments so incredibly challenging, I thought that helping other people to navigate that better than I did would be the best way to use that experience.
You raised such a good point, because for so many, well, there's a running joke anyway, which is if you speak multiple languages, you're called multilingual. If you speak two languages, you're called bilingual. And if you speak one language, you're called American. And there's a sense in which our unique history and geographical positioning has allowed us to not realize some of the dynamics happening that we're embedded in. And there's a sense of personal discovery that happens for people when they go somewhere, not just as a tourist, but for an extended period, whether it's to work or to serve or to, you know, partake in some sort of nonprofit, where their extended engagement is a really rude awakening to the reality of the fact that people do things differently. They move differently. They eat differently. They speak different language, obviously. But so many of the background assumptions simply don't
apply,
match exactly. And then I want to also talk about you coming back, because that works in reverse as well. But
still in recovery on that
still
one.
Still in recovery, right? So talk to us a little bit about what initially took you there. You said it was your technical skills and expertise, but let's get really concrete for a minute, because a lot of, especially younger folks, but this applies to older ones as well, are trying to figure out, they're intrigued by international work and they don't know where to start. Maybe they're in college, maybe they're not, and they're just trying to find their way to something interesting. How did it go for you?
So how do I answer all six questions at once? I don't know.
Yeah, one at a time.
All right, I'll do my best here. I would say, start off by saying I was very fortunate, the timing of this. Well, fortunate and unfortunate. It was a very strange experience being asked to go overseas for 12 months after, it was 3 days after September 11th, 2001, that I was ased to go. And so the whole world was kind of, well, especially the United States, was kind of, we were on high alert, freak out level. I don't know.
Yeah.
You can describe it any way you want.
Shock was a big part of
shock,
it.
Shock, there you go. Thank you.
Confusion, anger. But for companies in particular, there was a sense of urgency, either to stabilize operations or to try to get them back on track. And
immediately.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, planes hadn't started flying yet.
Right. So. Right. So I was asked. I didn't leave 3 days after. Right. It took a couple of weeks to work out visas and residency and all of that. It was only supposed to be 12 months in Germany, but the reason that I went, I'll go back a little bit. So, because you did ask multiple questions in there. I think that I was fortunate with the timing because, again, fortunate, unfortunate. We didn't have, think pre-Google, think pre-wireless internet, think pre-smartphone. So being dropped into Europe with zero cultural education into Germany, which is, you know, as you might imagine, fairly rigid in the way it likes to get things done. That is, what did you call that? A rude awakening. I think really fabulous way to put it. Being the minority, especially a 30-year-old female in a room full of Germans who had a very specific idea about the way things should be done, yet with my ingrained American United States education that our way is the way and the only way, to say that I had to adapt, that I had a big job of adaptation at my hands is the understatement of the decade.
Yeah. And what you had to adapt was kind of everything.
Kind of.
I'm projecting here, but I've been in that situation. Yeah. Where, so you had to adapt the way you think, the way you plan, the way you invite people to a meeting, the way you show up in a meeting.
Whether or not you smile when you walk down the hallway.
Yes.
Or you make absolutely no reaction. Otherwise, people think you're the village idiot.
Right. Now, what are some other ways? I mean, I just kind of threw out a few casual ones, but I think there's some substantive ones. How did you find professional life different in Europe than in the United States?
In the United States, I think we have much more propensity to wing it. We talk off the cuff. We don't necessarily come with boatloads of facts to every single meeting. One of the things that I had to do when I arrived in Germany, I was given a 12-month assignment to do create a piece of technical documentation on software strategy. Not the most exciting stuff, however important. And I had gone to, once I received the assignment, I went to a meeting with a room full of German developers and asked every question that I could imagine. And got my facts straight, went back to work. But as I said, this the duration of this activity was supposed to be 12 months. So a few months later, I thought, I have some more questions and I want to make sure I'm doing this the right way, at least the way they need it to be delivered. And so I asked for another meeting. And they thought, you want to talk about this again? Why do you want to talk about this again? We've already been through all this. So I couldn't imagine what in the world the holdup would be to having another discussion. One of my German teammates said to me, well, they think you just can't work independently, that you need handholding, which wow. Obviously is not what you want to hear at this stage of your professional career. But what I now know, because I've actually studied intercultural communication, that is, it's about uncertainty avoidance. And if you have a room full of developers who came to this meeting and prepared absolutely every conceivable question, the answer to those questions that they could imagine, they didn't want to do it again. So anyway,
right.
We had the meeting.
You had the meeting. Now, you've lived on four continents, as you mentioned. You've successfully executed projects in 10 countries, traveled to more than 50. And so this early deep end immersion, kind of jumping off into the deep end of the pool, so to speak, turned into something that you, I guess, became a little more at home in as you moved from place to place? Or was every time that same sense of foreignness, for lack of a better
shock word.
Yeah.
Good question. I'd like to call myself terminally curious, but I'm not sure if that was the reason that all this happened or the result of it, to be honest with you. It's quite addicting to travel to all these different locations. And then it really became a full-time affair to try to figure each one out as I went. However, I definitely will say that it was never easy. Not once. Even when I thought, I think the biggest mistake probably that you can make was when I moved to Australia, for example, and I thought, oh, well, they're somewhat similar. This is probably going to work out great. I was not right.
I've been to Australia, but it's been a long time. I was there as a 15-year-old in 1988 for the World's Fair, the Expo. And I remember some differences, but at 15, I don't think you're exposed to enough. What would surprise people to know about how life is different in Australia?
I will just give a little bit of a nod to a mentor and friend, Dr. George Renwick. He actually lives here in Carefree, Arizona, and he wrote a book in 1991 about his professional career consulting and corporate Australia. He wrote a book called American-Australian Interactions, 1991, just don't forget that. And in this book, he talked about how professional women working in Australia were in for a rough ride. We're in for a difficult road ahead. And he particularly mentioned women from the United States because equality was a thing here at that point in time.
We were getting there. We're not there yet.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I had far to go.
We tell the truth around here. We are not there.
Yeah, well, we thought we were then, let's say.
Sure. Well, some things had moved.
Yeah, there were roads and things. But anyway, this book, as I said, was written in 1991. I read it in 2012, I guess. No, sorry. When I came back. So basically, the end point is in 30 years, nothing's changed. So the predominance of sexual harassment, bullying, intimidation is much more mainstream in Australia than one might imagine.
Mm. Mm.
And in a male-dominated field of technology, yeah, times a million.
You know, it's funny. You talk about some things you try to make sense of after the fact. Other things you can prepare for, and then you learn that what you prepared for and what, you know, it's like the...
Like this show.
Like this show, for example. What you prepared for and what we're actually doing here are not the same thing, I'm sure. But... You know, the old saying from the military context that no battle plan, I mean, old, like it's 18th century old. the Prussian general said no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy. And it's like I used to tell students, listen, I can try to tell you some of these things, but in reality, you're going to have to go out there and make mistakes.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I personally never learned anything except the hard way.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know,
it certainly has an impact, doesn't it?
So here you are now realizing that you've got this personal... body of knowledge, some of which is in the form of knowledge and some of which is in the form of experience, which takes some work to turn into knowledge. But you then set out to help executives, to help teams navigate some of this landscape, right?
That's exactly right.
How do you do that? Because you did it for yourself as you had to.
The hard way, right? The hard survival way, mode.
Like we all do.
Right.
And if you survive... You're now at a point where this is where, you know, you need to guide those who are going to be in the trenches, in the field, as it were. Mm. How do you do it?
I appreciate that you asked the question, I think, because there's a very big misconception out there that intercultural communication, intercultural intelligence is about saying, okay, Mexicans are like this and the Chinese are like this, and this will happen when you go to X, Y, or Z. And, you know, that's just not reality because, as you mentioned, the world is complex, reality is complex, and it's truly about teaching people how to react better and more consistently to be more effective in that complex reality. So what my intention and what I do with my clients is to help people, support people to suspend that ingrained automated way of thinking that we grew up with, whatever your nationality was when you started out on this planet. And to, if you can suspend your reflexive way of behaving and your perceptions and put that aside for a minute while learning and understanding a completely other set of behavioral cultural norms, then you have a whole new set of approaches to work with.
Yeah.
You have all this other information and ways to get to solutions that you didn't have before.
You raise such an important point because there is a tendency to think, well, I need to go get the book, you know, like Doing Business in Mexico for Dummies or something, right? I don't think there is such a book, but that kind of thing where I need to learn about them, how they do it. This was a very common in the late 90s with Japan. You know, how there were movies about it. Sean Connery was in one, you know,
Gung Ho.
Right? All these sort of things of like, well, don't you know the Japanese are actually really different? Like, oh, no kidding. Thank you, genius.
Surprise.
You need Hollywood to tell me that. I mean, as an anthropologist, for better or for worse, Ruth Benedict had written her book, Chrysanthemum and the Sword, to try to explain the enemy in, you know, the Second World War. But anyway.
We still use terms like that, by the way.
I digress.
Anyway. Just saying.
We don't, but there are people that do. I'm aware. So the idea that intercultural fluency somehow means learning about them, but staying who you are and having some sort of unexamined relationship to yourself.
Right.
And if you just learn a little bit of the language or the mannerisms or, you know, kind of cheap pet tricks, I like to call them.
Exactly.
Some greetings and some etiquette.
Right.
That somehow
magic will happen.
It's just going to work. Mm-hmm. Right. When in reality, it sounds like, and I love that you're saying this, the real work is on yourself.
Absolutely.
To become more empathetic, more flexible, more aware.
Right.
Talk about that. How do you do that kind of work with people? How does the coaching process happen?
Well, I think that the reality is when you are in an environment that's completely opposite from anything you ever imagined being in or were prepared yourself for, let's just say the work becomes evident about what you need to rein in. I think it becomes more evident than if you're in your own environment with, you know, team members that are more homogenous, more like you. You stand out more. But you had something you raised at the beginning of that question. I can't remember exactly what you said.
Doing the work to understand yourself.
Mm. Right. If you don't understand yourself, you might as well.
And this is tricky because, listen, whether it's, you know, with American undergraduates or with international executives or working with people in other contexts who want to do business effectively here in the United States, self-awareness is key. And yet teaching self-awareness, guiding self-awareness is hard. I would say, if I was going to put in a shameless plug for you, the number one best reason to hire an intercultural communication expert or coach is because you can guarantee you're going to miss a lot
right.
about yourself,
right.
that having someone as a sounding board is going to help you see. So you want a shortcut to that kind of self-awareness.
That's absolutely true.
It's not a shortcut to fluency
no.
in the intricacies of Chinese deal making or whatever.
Exactly.
It's a shortcut to the self-awareness that allows you to be in those conversations.
That's 100% right.
Right?
Yeah.
So
it
how does that
you
get
to be
done?
Present and to truly appreciate the evolution of the relationship rather than sitting there and thinking, is that normal? Did I say that? Should I say that? Should I have said this? And I think the other thing that I remember now, the point I wanted to make is that often the misconception is that by having this sort of training in your organization, for example, that people think, oh, they want me to assimilate. They want me to be Japanese, think Chinese, however it is, whatever it is, that culture. And no one's asking you to assimilate, only to appreciate and to leverage the fact that when you have a multicultural team, for example, different nationalities, there is research all across the board that says that the results that team will achieve will be more robust. There will be more solutions put across the board and much more so than a homogenous team members from one race or nationality.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's certainly strength in diversity, but only when we are aware of how it works, how we work together.
And to leverage it.
And to appreciate when it's time to step aside and let someone else lead, you know, what's required in those conversations. I'm curious, Jennifer, when a company or an individual executive engages Worldwise Coaching, they know that maybe they're already doing business or they want to be expanding. What are the situations when it becomes important and even urgent for someone to work with you? Like, what are they dealing with that makes, everyone knows that you should eat right and exercise, but nobody actually deals with things until there's a pain or they need to go to the doctor. So typically when they're experiencing certain things, they'll start to look for the solution that they really should have baked in
right.
from the beginning. When do people engage you? What are the kind of situations they're dealing with?
The simple answer is that you cannot be successful without cultural education in any sort of international business endeavor, period. The research, I think the numbers now put the figure somewhere at about 70% of all international business failures happen because of miscommunication, cultural miscommunication, misunderstanding. So the obvious, as you say, the textbook answer would be before you start to have these activities, before you start to break new ground. But realistically speaking, when it happens, I've seen it happen in various different timings. Often when you have mergers of departments, you have two departments that suddenly have to work together, example, an outsourcing situation where, you know, perhaps it's India, perhaps it's Malaysia, Thailand, whatever, that, that suddenly have a department in the Philippines is coming to, in another country that you need to leverage to execute whatever your business goals are. And then suddenly those deadlines aren't being met. Delays are happening. And then the problem is that once, if you don't do this in advance, an ideal situation, doing it ahead of time will save everybody. Is that shortcut as you imagine? Is that way to more, to quicker success, let's say that. If you don't do that, what you're going to end up with are teams of professionals who suddenly feel that their professional reputation is at stake, and ego gets involved, and escalation and drama. And then really you have a hard time of recouping that time. Yeah. First, you have to bring it down and
you gotta cool everything off.
Exactly.
Everyone's amygdala is being hijacked by the threat of status or losing their money or their whatever. Yes.
Exit visas everywhere.
Everywhere.
So yeah, first you have to calm it down. And obviously that takes time, money, and effort. And you know, sometimes, as I've said a few times now, the research is out there that, you know, sometimes those relationships can't be repaired. And then you're looking at a whole new set of expenses and time wasted when you have to bring in new people, new teams, et cetera.
Let me ask you a question to kind of tie this up a little bit. We'll turn to Dr. Jeff McGee in just a moment. But you've worked across the spectrum of companies, from Fortune 100 companies to small firms, in, you know, working with independents. What are some of the trends that are positive? What are some of the things that companies or individuals are doing right that you're excited about and you want to bring to other organizations?
I think that the simple fact that there is recognition that this is a field is a massive improvement over, let's say, where we were 20 years ago. I mean, there were these kind of books that you mentioned, the very simplistic ones about how to hold a business card and, you know, who should sit where at a meeting table. There has been a lot more in-depth study in the field of intercultural communication, even though I would say that in general, it's not leveraged anywhere near to the capacity that it should, could be. I'm pleased that these conversations are being had, and especially in light of the political climate across the globe. You know, I'm not necessarily referring to just the United States. I mean, these issues are across the globe.
Absolutely. I mean, the reemergence, I wouldn't say the rise, that would be ignorant of history, but the reemergence of nationalism.
Right.
Bordering on crypto-fascism,
right.
In many places shows that we've got a long way to go. We being the big we, humans, and I'm super pro-human. I'm long on humans. However, we got to grow up together about what we have in common as well as what we have that are differences, which right. don't need to divide us, but do in many ways. So.
And when I'm seeing these articles, that the million and one press pieces about trade wars, about immigration, all of those hot topics that involve multiple cultures, what I'm also seeing is press to the opposite effect that promotes harmony or at least a willingness to understand. And I don't remember seeing that in the past when these things have come up.
Yeah, it's very enheartening. I mean, I remember decades ago in the Middle East where I have long experience, the common narrative when you'd get into a taxi, and I'm fluent in Arabic, so I was just moving around talking to
I'll
people.
Just throw that out there.
And, you know, drop it in. It's what we do around here. But why I say that is it would lead to interesting conversations that would usually start with, oh, you speak Arabic.
Oh, I'm sure.
Why? And this is pre-9/11, but still the idea that, you know, I was some kind of CIA operative or something. And I would tell them, listen, I'm a student. I'm doing a degree in anthropology at Berkeley. Like, sure, that's nice. But what would happen is they would launch into a lecture routinely about their frustration with U.S. foreign policy. But then they would assure me that they loved American people and that they understood that your government, you know, is doing one thing, but we love Americans. We love America. In fact, can you help me get a visa? I would like to go there. Right. So it was this really wonderful, interesting, fascinating conversation. And that all changed somewhere. I'm not sure exactly when, but somewhere it wasn't 9/11 related, but it was in that, you know, 5-year window, maybe 2000 to 2004.
Yeah.
When suddenly the conversation was, now, wait a minute, you elect your officials, right? So the government is kind of your fault in a way. Mm-hmm. And no amount of, you know, listen, I didn't vote for that guy or the other guy, whatever, would help, because they started to have this more nuanced conversation. And again, in many cases, in countries where there's no opportunity to determine, you know, the government that runs your life, the police states that I was traveling through, that sense of frustration was like, now maybe we should blame you because you do vote for these people.
Right. You have the ability.
You have the ability to do that. So I think, again, we're all kind of trying to get past our stereotypes together. I don't want to tie this up in too neat of a bow, because there's a lot of issues here. It's just such important work that I'm fascinated by.
I just want to say how lucky you are to have that early experience that you had, because going over to Germany in 2001, then Holland 2002, 2005, 6, 7, whatever it was, I had the exact opposite experience. I was held to the mat often. Yeah. About the decisions that George Bush was making. You can imagine why that would be. And Europeans were extremely upset with the way that things were going down. I remember very vividly being in The Hague, and there was a demonstration where there were, I don't know, probably like 100 people holding a huge billboard in blood red letters saying, take Bush to The Hague.
Yeah.
Take him to the international...
Well, and it's unpopular to say, and we don't delve too much into the political, you know, mudslinging on this program, but the reality is that in many different parts of the world, those conversations do not change when our administrations change, because the people on the receiving end of drone strikes, for example, don't see that this is a Republican or a Democratic thing. They see the national security apparatus perpetuating many of the same activities. So for us here, it's easy to get consumed in this is my team versus your team. In many parts of the world, they look at the last 40 years as simply one set of national security initiatives with slight flavor and slight variation.
But right. And that wasn't a remark about the particular
president.
No, I understand. At the time.
I'm adding this.
The American shock of naivete.
I was hoping more things would have changed from 2008 to 2018. But again, that's a totally different conversation.
We could talk about that for many hours.
We should over drinks somewhere when we're not on the air.
Good idea.
Jennifer Burge, CEO of Worldwise Coaching. We'll come back and probably have some more things to say, but thank you so much for sharing that insight with us. Your unique experience creates such a valuable place to begin these tough conversations.
Thanks, Andrew.
I'm grateful for you. Dr. Jeff McGee, CEO of Cross-Cultural Dynamics. You're an Arizona-based company, and you take a different approach to this issue of training, leadership development, and so on. Talk to us a little bit about your work. What do you do, and how do you serve folks?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, so I don't have the experience of leaving the country and these great experiences that you and Jennifer have had. That's by choice. I don't like to fly that long. So five hour flight's good for me.
Yeah. Forget Australia South Africa.
That one's off the books for you.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, domestically speaking, just through some experiences that I've had, I've been able to, develop the company and start the company Cross-Cultural Dynamics about a couple years ago. And we really reach out to any type of sector, whether it's a nonprofit, church, businesses, education, city governments we work in. So we've been working in this capacity for a couple of years now.
Now, your contribution here is equally important, because the reality is that culture doesn't mean international. Different organizations have different environments, and we now loosely in the business world call that culture. We think sometimes that culture means, you know, the cold brew, the foosball table, the bean bags and things of that nature. But there's an environment in organizations, whether they're nonprofits, faith-based organizations, corporations, and cultural dynamics must address all of those things. What are some of the core issues that you deal with in your programs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the very first things we like to address in our program is actually defining what is culture. Just from experiences with facilitating trainings and consultations with people, in their minds, culture is just a racial thing. Because remember, we're talking about a domestic, cross-cultural, right? Not international.
Right. Like, so, it's a politically correct word for skin color or something like that.
Correct.
Gotcha.
Correct. So understanding what culture is very important, right? And as you're saying, you know, there's organizational cultures, right? For example, Bank of America is different from Wells Fargo. You know, ASU is different from NAU. They're both universities, right? Both banks are banking systems, right? But they have different cultures, right? So what we like to do is go in and define culture. What is culture? And then we start explaining from there, you know, how can we improve culture, whether it's within your leadership team, whether it's in with your organizational culture, or whether culture, we take it as, you know, race, age, gender, able-bodiedness. We talk about that and help people understand the different cultures within an organization.
Yeah, that's really great. You know, as an anthropologist, I mean, this is something that my academic discipline struggled with for 120 years. They wanted to make culture theirs as an object of analysis, description, engagement, practice.
Right.
And yet defining what this social science is the science of, well, if it's a science of culture, then what is culture? It turned out to be a little bit of a tricky thing. In fact, I went to grad school at Berkeley, and our Kroeber Hall was where the anthropology department is. Alfred Kroeber was one of the early American anthropologists who really helped codify the discipline. He wrote a book with Clive Cluckhone, it's always hard to say those together, called Culture. And they tried to come up with a definition, and they compared all the different definitions, like 212 competing definitions in there. And they came up with some kind of best of all things. But still, we're talking about culture like it was a noun,
right?
Like it was a thing out there that, you know, like a chair or a rock, if you had the right tools and the right lens, you could look at this thing that was out there, describe it, analyze it, write about it, build a career around it.
Right.
And at the same time, there was some uneasiness with that idea that culture is a thing, because it's invisible. It shapes our way of seeing the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what's the value in that inquiry? When you go into an organization, you want to define culture. Why? Why do that?
Right. Because that's a great question, because I laugh. I'm over laughing as you're saying that, because in trainings, we talk about this idea of classification. So you remember back in third grade, we learned how to classify, you know, what is a fish? This goes into the fish group. This goes into the bird category, right? So as people, we have this propensity to just classify everything. So I blame that, our classification and our wanting to classify everything, as how we explain culture, right? So when we look at culture, we always look at the culture as a deficit. So as you're saying, we look at most cultures as a deficit. So if something's different from us, we find deficiencies in it, and then we blame those deficiencies on that particular group or organization. One of the things we do, we actually look at it from a more unique approach, right? We do what's called an asset-based approach. So instead of looking at a culture and saying what's wrong with it, we look at a culture and say what's going right. And it's more of a strength-based findings that we do. And we want to say, okay, how can we learn the strength of a particular culture and then grow from there, right? So as an anthropologist, as you probably are familiar with those terms, Edic and Emic research, right?
Yep.
Right. So we talk about that a lot too when you're talking about explaining culture, right? Understanding culture. From an Edic perspective, it's more what I like to call a Google search, right? You go on your computer and just type in a particular organization or people group to explain or to understand that particular group. But from an Emic approach, it's more of an internal investigation, right? I always compare that movie Instinct back in 1999 with Anthony Hopkins and Cuba Gooding Jr. and how Anthony Hopkins went into the jungle to learn about gorillas, right? So he's learning about gorillas and he actually became one because he was there for so long. So the movie goes on to say, you know, they brought him out and then Cuba's job as a counselor was to get him acclimated to humanity, right? But that's the same thing that we do with culture and understanding culture, right? Most of us do more of an Edic type of research and say, okay, let me look at this culture from the sidelines, right? But the best way to do is get entrenched and go in there and learn about the culture without bias.
Yeah, I mean, Clifford Geertz wrote an essay in the late 70s on anthropology from the native's point of view.
Right.
Basically, the idea was the real distinction in that piece was we were searching for experience near concepts and explanations, not experience distant ones. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's one thing for Bronislaw Malinowski to spend this time, again, war, politics. He was a Polish citizen. It was World War I. He was essentially confined to an island in the South Pacific, wasn't allowed to leave. So while he was there, he started writing about the natives and sleeping with them and doing all kinds of nefarious things. But if you read The Sexual Life of Savages, which is a very scintillating title and it's not that interesting of a book for most non-professional anthropologists, what you're getting are, I mean, it's ethnographic richness and so on, but it really is an external evaluation. I love what you said about categorizing things. We just have this natural desire. Well, I need to put this in this bucket, this in that bucket. And we're searching for the mistake is, of course, thinking that those categories are out there in the observed phenomenon rather than over here in our analysis, interpretation, the judgment of it. So, why did you get started doing this? I mean, you're obviously passionate about the topic. You alluded to the fact that there were some things that led you to start the company. What's the backstory? How did you get into this?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things I do as a leader is I always promise myself I would never forget the people on the front lines. And from remembering my experiences on the front lines and working with communities and working with people, I understand the frustrations it is to work with a leadership team that doesn't get it. And so through my research and through my experiences as a consultant, I've come to really become passionate about informing leaders and reminding leaders of what it's like to be on the front lines, so to speak. From doing research in the Phoenix community here in we'll call it a lower income community or under resourced community, I like to say, decisions were being made for this community by people that weren't living in the community, people living on the outside of the community, that Edic type of research, right? And just me being on the front lines and seeing the frustration of the community there, it really broke my heart. Mm-hmm. And just remembering from my own personal experience of what I've been through, how people judge you based on whether an appearance or judge you based on socioeconomic factors or any other factors you can think of. I really became passionate about putting together a program and a curriculum to really educate leaders and organizations on how to interact with people in a successful way where everyone feels inclusive and there's equitable policies and procedures within an organization or within a community. So it's my life's dream, my life's goal to continue these conversations. And I don't want to shame people at all, but at the end of the day, I want us all to be able to work together and collaborate together and support one another so we all can achieve our goals and our purpose in life.
Yeah. you know, I don't want to press you too much on this, but you've alluded several times to things you've gone through. Do you want to be a little more specific about what shaped the way, you know, at some point before Dr. Jeff McGee was filing his doctoral research and completing his education and going out into the world to do this work, if you work back somewhere in there, I'm sure there's a 20-something or a 12-year-old or a 6-year-old. What got you to this point?
Yeah.
Connect those dots for us.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if we have enough time to go through everything, but I ascribe to the African-American culture. And growing up, I grew up on the East Coast. So I did grow up away from here. So I grew up on the East Coast. I was faced with a lot of challenges growing up as an African-American in communities that weren't like mine. We grew up in a community that was mostly Caucasian, and I live on the outskirts of communities that were all Caucasian. So going into those types of communities, I've experienced a lot of racism and I have stories I could tell, but I don't want to share right now, but that just really touched me in a very deep way. Yeah. I'm a very sensitive person when it comes to emotional intelligence. And so those experiences have stuck with me down through the years. So instead of looking at them and having those experiences impact me in a negative way, I wanted to reshape those and use those experiences in a positive way and share those experiences with other people so we can live in a country, in a community where everyone's included, and it doesn't have to do with a racial profile or an age, you know, discrimination or gender or able-bodiedness, right? So some of my experiences in life have really shaped.
You know, I really appreciate you saying that for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think the conversation around, let's call it sensitivity for lack of a better word, I don't think we have a good description for this. I'm no psychologist, but I don't think the understanding that the more empathetic you are, the more these kinds of things affect you. And some of the hardest people you'll meet were the most sensitive, but the path they took was closing off, putting calluses there to not be hurt again in that way, emotionally, you know, psychically, spiritually, whatever, but to experience the pain of those humiliations, those physical abuses, whatever the thing is, right? And so the idea that you took those experiences, as many people do, but it's not talked about a lot, and decided right. to try to channel those into a constructive, proactive, in a way is admirable, because it means you got to keep dealing with the stuff that you're sensitive to and that hurts you.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's this movement, as you probably heard of, the trauma-informed care movement.
Yes.
And you hear about schools now becoming more trauma-informed. So trauma-informed, for those that don't know, it's when you're looking at a student going through a challenging time, you're not asking what's wrong with that person. You're asking what happened to that person, right? Yeah. So you're showing more empathy and saying, okay, X, Y, and Z happened to this person. How can we help, right? So one of the things we talk about and we teach about is this concept of resiliency, right? So resiliency is you've gone through something traumatic, but you're able to use what you've gone through to shape and new ideas and help people understand what people like you are going through, so they can take a different approach to helping that person.
That's so powerful. I think I'm inspired right now. I want to go start some institute for trauma-informed care of humanity.
Right.
No
because
doubt.
The growing up that we were talking about that we all need to do together mm-hmm. can only be done. I mean, Germany, talk about a country carrying a very painful legacy. It has still barely only begun to deal with in terms of the role Germany played in
right.
the
no,
mid-20th
century.
I was
century. Absolutely shocked how many people are still living that reality, even though that was how many years ago?
Right. And or living the opposite, the antithesis, the resistance to, like, in a way that You know, atheists are just as Christian, just in the reverse. Like they're still tied to the same thing and just resisting it in its polar opposite. No offense to my atheist friends out there. There, by the way, side note, just to keep this fully inclusive, that if you want to follow an absolutely hilarious and critical and informed and interesting Twitter account, look at the Church of Satan and what they're doing, trolling Christian organizations, trying to bring the implicit bias to light with a bit of a sense of humor about it. It's unlikely. And I'm sure what I just said is going to freak some people out, but right. At least go look at it. There is a registered religious organization called the Church of Satan.
How did you happen upon that, Adrian?
I am a well-read and widely traveled human being. Jeff, you've referred to your curriculum, and I know you and your team have developed this approach. It includes some unexpected and interesting things like mindfulness as well as leadership development. Talk about that curriculum and what people get when they bring you in to work with them.
Yeah. So when I first started this, I just started doing the culturally competent curriculum, which is great. But after talking with my team, we said, you know, in order to really bring about change, we need to focus on leaders. Focusing on employees is great, but if we want to see change within our systems, we need to educate leaders and collaborate and support leaders. So from our organization's standpoint, a leader is someone who is culturally competent and mindful. So earlier, you both were talking about awareness. Right. So through my research, I developed a model, and the first point on the model is understand. So understand is learning about yourself, being more aware of yourself. A word that doesn't get used too often, but understanding your cultural worldview. Mm-hmm. So understanding your worldview and how you think and how you make decisions. By visiting that, right, we can start having conversations on how to bring about change, right? So when a company hires us to come in, we put together, we have a really strong research-based curriculum. We have a team of researchers on our team, and a bunch of us are doctorates, so you can understand what that conversation can look like sometimes. So we have a really strong research-based curriculum. A lot of experience on a team. So when we come into an organization, you're getting the best of the best, right? Up to date, more practical information. Our trainers are very interactive. So we're not coming saying and dumping a bunch of knowledge on you. We want to hear from you and understand your culture worldview so we can move forward from there. And then our curriculum, we customize it for each client. So as I alluded to before, you know, you have your Bank of America, your Wells Fargo, and ASU, NAU. While they do kind of the same things, they have two different cultures. So we want to come in and say, okay, what are your needs? What are you trying to get to? What are your objectives? And we customize our curriculum to match your goals and your objectives.
Talk a little bit about the mindfulness part, because this is something that, as with trauma-informed care, people are becoming increasingly aware, well, first of all, of mental health in general, but mental health often has a stigma because, again, it was referring to the pathology as opposed to mental wellness, which is, of course, what we're really after, which is a sense of well-being, calmness, confidence, presence, et cetera. So mindfulness as a set of practices designed to bring wellness rather than deal with what's broken, fits right into what you were talking about with asset-based leadership or asset-based training.
Right.
So how does that all fit together?
Yeah. So that's a great question, because whenever I was talking about the model, and the first point of the model is to understand yourself, right? So it's being mindful of yourself, right? My colleague who works with us at Cross Cultural, Dr. Duffy and I, she does our mindfulness work. And her and I just recently did a training on mindfulness and its impact on decreasing implicit bias. And it's this idea of with mindfulness is, as she explains it, is so mindfulness right now, you talk about stimulus and a reaction, right? So think about driving a car on a freeway and getting cut off by someone, right? So that's the stimulus. And then you have an immediate reaction. So most of our reactions is, you know, you're cussing that person out, you're flipping them off, you're angry. I don't do that. Mm-mm. But a lot of other people do.
Right.
So mindfulness.
I've heard about this thing.
Yeah. Something I read online. But mindfulness is this space in between stimulus and reaction, right? So in the same analogy, someone cut you off. So now you're having a mindful moment. You're kind of taking a second, collecting your thoughts, addressing how you feel, you know, your anger, you're upset. Yeah. Now you can move to a reaction state, yeah. right? Typically, the hope is that you're going to make a better decision than, you know, try to run someone off the road or something like that, right? So to put that into perspective for our cultural competency and leadership program, mindfulness really helps leaders to take a step back and take a break and understand how they make decisions, how they react to something that comes across their desk or a conversation that's being had or an objective that they're trying to accomplish. Mindfulness puts them in this space where they can reflect and think through things before reacting and then understanding themselves and their worldview in order so they can be able to collaborate with the people they're working with.
Yeah, very well said. You know, what I'm excited about with both of your work is you're in the business, or at least this is my category for it. Mm-hmm. You're in the business of helping people see the invisible.
Right.
And what's so cool about that is that we like to think that knowing is our access to doing better things. So we seek knowledge because that knowledge is going to give us a competitive advantage and that it is going to allow us to take certain actions and so on. But what we miss is the context that we're often embedded in. And what we miss is that the way we see and the way we know is already shaped by things.
Right.
Jeff mentioned implicit bias, mm-hmm. which is a particularly thorny one because we all have it.
Right.
And knowing we have it and even studying it does not remove it.
Right.
You know, it's same with cognitive bias at a more kind of fundamental brain level. Mm-hmm. The scientists that have given us the array of 16 or whatever it is, different forms of cognitive bias, are themselves not free from it just because they're the world's most, you know, foremost expert on that subject, right? So we're trying to unlearn and begin to see things that were invisible. And this is what's so interesting. Because on the one hand, you're talking about culture, you're talking about international work, you're talking about intercultural communication, but it's not that at all. It is, but it's something more fundamental.
Right.
You're talking about helping humans human
right.
better,
right.
more effectively.
I like that one better than adulting.
Together.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Jennifer, circling back to you here, what are your thoughts on this? Why do organizations need these conversations? I mean, you and Dr. McGee take different approaches to some overlapping things, but also there's plenty of differences, but this is so essential. What do organizations need to know about this type of work?
Well, to me, it's, as I mentioned before, it's about harvesting potential. You know, all of us can do better when we know more. And the fact of the matter is, the blinders are very often on due to the fact that, you know, there are deadlines, there are management responsibilities. You need to do 85,000 things at once. Your phone's going off. There's 300 emails and you don't have time to sit back and just take that, as you called it, mindful moment. I mean, just take a minute before you react. And I think that in the end, harvesting this potential, maximizing this potential, it's only going to, I don't want to say increase your, it's not about increasing the bottom line anymore, I guess is what I'm really trying to say. It's about increasing, how would you say that? Your
awareness?
Well, it's awareness, but it's more, it's being able to approach an initiative or a, whatever it is that you're particularly working on, objective from a common perspective. Mm-hmm. Because if you have
you're so right here. Because what we often focus on in these conversations, or what it seems like some leaders focus on, is, well, what's the benefit? What's the ROI? So I'm going to hire you guys. You're going to come in. I'm going to write you a check. You're going to do this work with my people. What are we going to have to show for it? And what's almost even more important than answering that question is asking the other question of the cost of not doing this.
Correct.
We've taken so many things for granted now, 150 years into this type of organized capitalistic endeavor. The nature of bureaucracies has not changed since Max Weber wrote about them in the 19th century.
We were just talking about that.
And, yeah, we were.
And we don't know what the cost is. You know, how much dumb expenses could be freed up by smartening up the way we work together. You know, it's really incumbent on us to do this kind of education. And that leaves me with a kind of a final question. How do you know when you're talking to someone who's already part of the way there, they see what you provide, they see the benefit in it. What are some of those tells that let you know you're dealing with an enlightened leader who recognize, you know, in other words, you can't sell the unsellable.
Correct.
You need to be engaged with people who at least already have some inkling of the fact that this is true. You can't be in the convincing business or you're not going to get any work. So what are some of the things in your experience you've found let you know that an individual leader or an organization is right for what you do?
Okay, I'll go ahead. Since you hesitated for 1 second, you had your mindful moment. If for me personally, I think it's speaking with someone who has had the experience. Because if you haven't had the experience, honestly, you really don't know what you're in for.
Right.
And the second telltale sign, or at least I'd say area of potential, is when I'm outside the U.S. Because a lot of us here in the United States tend to be very... not as willing to adapt as the folks that have need to deal with America and the United States on a daily basis.
Yeah, that's, and I want to piggyback on what you're saying. What I have found from leaders that want to further engage into the work that we, Jennifer and I do, are the ones that say, okay, they see the society is changing. And as Jennifer alluded to, those blinders are off and they can see the demographics are changing throughout our country. And in order to have your country or your company or organization be more sustainable over the years, you have to adopt these diversity, equity, inclusive practices, right? In order to grow your company. The ones, and from what I've seen, the companies that don't want to do this, it's sad to say they're not going to be around.
No, they're not.
Too much longer. Because you have to adopt these practices, and millennials, for example, who make up they're the biggest generation, in our workforce right now, they're getting it and they're understanding for the most
part. Demanding it.
They're demanding it. And they're saying, well, what's taking you guys, us older people, longer to get this, right? So, those organizations that, have those blinders off and say, yes, we want to grow. We want to diversify. We want to curate these equitable spaces for people. Those are the companies that we're talking to. Those are the ones that are sending us emails and phone calls and wanting our services. So, and they know that innovation and creativity come about come through diversity. And they really get that and understand that.
Yeah. It occurs to me, and I shouldn't use sports metaphors because I'm not really a sports fan. Chess team, you know, nerd culture with my people.
I shouldn't tell all these people about Adrian.
You know, it really comes down to, are the organizations playing defense or are they playing offense when it comes to these issues? Are they relegating conversations about diversity and inclusion to the HR department or are they embracing this aggressively, going after this, trying to move the needle, move the proverbial ball down the field, whatever the metaphor is here? Are they embracing the reality as well as trying to move into where the puck is going?
Right.
Now I've really got – I thought I asked multi-part questions. Look at my multi-part metaphors.
Right.
I'm totally confused now.
And looking for ways to aggressively get out in front of that.
Right.
Rather than protecting themselves, trying to keep the status quo in place and having a culture and compensation structure and hiring practices and all the things like this culture, if it means anything, is going to show up in the world of practices.
Absolutely.
So how you know what you're dealing with is you look at what they're actually doing.
Absolutely.
In those micro examples, how are people paid? How are they hired? Who's doing the hiring? What happens to them after? Culture is a product of these actions and interactions.
Absolutely.
Over time. And it changes over time. So we shall see. Jennifer, what are you excited about as we wrap up the conversation? As you look to the future, what's on the horizon that really lights you up? I mean, at one level, this is, you know, dealing with this stuff could be in a very kind of Nordic or German sense of just, you know, technocratic execution of things. But that's not who you are. You've got a spark to you that's bigger than the bureaucracy part of it. As you look forward the next 12, 18 months, what are things happening that you are lit up about in this business? Are there trends, things that excite you?
As I mentioned before, I think it's the increasing awareness of the fact that there is a field of study and there is training and coaching that can enable people to execute better in the diverse reality that we live in that becomes more increasingly complex every day. So that's a huge thing. For me personally, you know, I've only been to 50 countries. So, I mean, what is that, a third?
Yeah, it depends on whose number you take. But right. 145 left if you count the U.S. number. 241 is the U.N.'s number. Anyway,
right.
Yeah, you got quite a few left.
It's been a very interesting experience to return to the United States, right? Yeah. So that with blinders removed and see some of the ways that people are thinking and behaving about culture here, which wouldn't have ever crossed my radar before I left. But it's also quite fascinating and lucky for me to be close to Mexico, as I have not done work in Mexico before. And I've got a lot going on there in the upcoming months. And it's a whole new secret code that I get to learn.
Yeah. Well, we met at the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations, which is a group that is one of a couple, you know, bodies that bring together like-minded right. folks, well, some of us anyway.
I don't play chess.
No, that wasn't the part that we had in common. That's great. Thanks for sharing that perspective, and thanks for being here for this conversation today. Jennifer Burge is the CEO of Worldwise Coaching and is wise in her own worldly ways. So she's the one to call for these things. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Adrian.
Jeff, what about you? As you look forward, what lights you up? What are you excited by? What gets you out of bed in the morning to keep doing this vital work?
Yeah, I guess what gets me out of bed every morning is seeing those leaders out there that are catching a glimpse of what can happen by them building on their cultural competencies and wanting to change their organizational culture. There's several organizations out there, I'm not going to mention by name, but they're in each sector that we have worked with that you're going to hear about because they are being champions and pioneers in their areas of expertise and then in their fields, where there a lot of other organizations are going to look to them for guidance. And so I'm excited to be a part of that and collaborate with those organizations and those groups. And just seeing people appreciate people and improving relationships, you know, across the board. So that's what gets me excited.
Very good. Dr. Jeff McGee, CEO of Cross Cultural Dynamics, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.